You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire. Updates from the UK's Ministry of Defense on Russia's war in Ukraine. On influence operations, the advantage still seems to go to Ukraine as Russian efforts look inward. Assessing the effects of hacktivism and cyber operations in the hybrid war, Mustang Panda rears up in European diplomatic networks. Ransomware hits a Romanian fuel distributor. Andrea Little-Limbago from Interos on data traps. Carol Terrio tracks the fight against deepfakes. And vulnerabilities are found in UPS devices? From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Tuesday, March 8th, 2022. The Russian army continues to exhibit surprising tactical and operational shortfalls. Its road-bound heavy forces, even as slow-moving as they prove to be, have clearly already outrun their logistic support. Having been unable to capture key Ukrainian cities, they've turned to heavy and indiscriminate targeting of civilians, despite a second negotiated round of ceasefires. The UK's Ministry of Defense yesterday afternoon tweeted an update on Russia's war against Ukraine and took particular notice of Moscow's attempts to control information. Quote, Russia is increasingly restricting domestic social media access to limit negative coverage of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This will further confine the information space and make it increasingly difficult for the Russian population to gain access to anything other than the Russian state official view. This indicates the Kremlin's concern over the Russian population's attitude to the conflict. End quote. Earlier this morning, the MOD added a spot report, quote, Ukrainian resistance against a Russian offensive toward Kyiv endures around the nearby towns of Hostomel, Bucha, Vorzel, and Irpin. Russia continues to directly target evacuation corridors, resulting in the death of several civilians whilst trying to evacuate Irpin. Due to heavy fighting in the town, it has reportedly been without heat, water, or electricity for several days. End quote. Moscow is recycling implausible and unsupported claims that Ukraine is attempting to create a dirty bomb, that is, a radiological catastrophe, by mining a research reactor in Kharkiv. Sputnik maintains that Russian forces are actually the heroes in Kharkiv, having secured the reactor and prevented the disaster the Ukrainians had prepared. Russian government-controlled media are also claiming that Ukraine is attempting to conceal a large-scale biowar program it's been operating with U.S. support and collusion. Neither of these seem to have any international legs, but then the audience is probably a domestic one. Russian domestic influence operations continue in other respects to rely heavily on censorship. There are also some signs of direct intimidation of journalists. Reporters in Odessa say they've received menacing emails. The Atlantic Council describes what appears to be a coordinated campaign of intimidation. Even the most assiduous propagandists seem to have trouble finding good help nowadays. Some of the emails were sent by people who forgot to delete the instructions that had been embedded in the sample text they were given. Things like, add here a few paragraphs on local specifics, or these emails should be disseminated every day to crush the morale, or send emails individually, not to a list, and think about painful dots to push on. We think painful dots are what Americans would call hot buttons. You know, you tell them and you tell them. The biggest obstacle to a successful Russian information campaign, however, apart from persuasion being inherently harder to achieve than confusion, may be the pervasive availability of social media and a large international journalistic presence in Ukraine. Unusual Western openness with intelligence, notably used for what some have called pre-bunking, the anticipation of Russian disinformation themes and the release of fact checks before the disinformation finds its legs, seems to also have played a part. A report late last week from Checkpoint Software gives a timely reminder that in any war, and in a hybrid war especially, early reports and claims should be treated with cautious skepticism. That applies to claims on behalf of both sides, which may or may not eventually be confirmed. Who's helping Russia defend its networks, and who's assisting them in recovering from cyberattacks? Huawei, the Indian news service WION reports. Australian Defense Minister Dutton, the Daily Mail says, has criticized Huawei for working on behalf of Russia and accused Moscow and Beijing of having an unholy alliance. The Conti Gang, which has publicly pledged its allegiance to Mr. Putin's war, has shrugged off the reputational damage it sustained when it was infiltrated by a Ukrainian hacker who released records of the gang's internal chatter. eSentire has published an extensive account of Conti's history and an assessment of its current capabilities. Attacks the group conducted against Western targets may have represented a contribution to Russian battlespace preparation. The U.S. FBI updated its alert concerning Ragnar Locker yesterday. Quote, as of January 2022, the FBI has identified at least 52 entities across 10 critical infrastructure sectors affected by Ragnar Locker ransomware, including entities in the critical manufacturing, energy, financial services, government, and information technology sectors. End quote. Ragnar Locker was composed by Russophone coders, and MITRE notes that Ragnar Locker doesn't encrypt files if it determines that its target is in either Russia or the near abroad. This makes it likely that its operators have enjoyed a privateer's immunity from Russian authorities. Operators, we stress, is a plural here. Ragnar Locker is a tool, not a threat actor, and it's been used by various gangs. Cyber espionage will follow crisis, and the Russian war against Ukraine is proving no exception. Proofpoint this morning released a report on the activities of TA-416, a Chinese APT also known as Mustang Panda. Its current interests have obviously been shaped by the war. TA-416 is targeting European diplomatic entities, including an individual involved in refugee and migrant services. It uses tracking pixels to help profile targets during its reconnaissance phase. The phishing emails that eventually deliver the payloads to TA-416's targets have often impersonated United Nations agencies. Quote, the multi-year campaign against diplomatic entities in Europe suggests a consistent area of responsibility belonging to TA-416, end quote. Bloomberg reports that ReSecurity found that threat actors succeeded in accessing the networks of 21 companies, most of them in the oil and gas sector, over a two-week period in February. ReSecurity declined to attribute the activity to any nation, but did go so far as to say that the activity seemed to be state-sponsored. Bloomberg notes that some of the incidents appear to overlap those Microsoft attributed to Strontium, also known as APT-28, and Fancy Bear, that is, Russia's GRU, military intelligence service. The timing and target selection are suggestive, circumstantially, of a Russian operation. The Hive ransomware gang has hit Romania's Rompetrol oil company, disrupting fuel stations throughout the country. Bleeping Computer says that the gang has demanded a $2 million ransom. Finally, researchers at security firm Armis this morning announced that they'd found 3 zero-day vulnerabilities in APC smart UPS devices. A UPS device is an uninterruptible power supply, something that provides emergency backup power for mission-critical assets. They're used in data centers, industrial plants, hospitals, and other places that need reliable, uninterrupted power. Until recently, UPS devices hadn't been considered security risks, but that's changed as more of these devices have become remotely managed and so networked. Armis calls the vulnerabilities taken together TL Storm, and they say they could be exploited to disable, disrupt, and destroy APC smart UPS devices and attached assets. APC is a unit of Schneider Electric. This is a case of responsible disclosure, and Armis has worked with Schneider, which has prepared and made available patches and mitigations that address the vulnerabilities. If you use these UPS devices, be sure to patch them. Today's episode is sponsored by SRM, your first call for cybersecurity and investigations. Threats today are evolving faster than ever before, and since 2005, SRM has pioneered tailored security solutions for global corporations and their executives. Whether it's defending against cyber attacks with their award-winning team of ethical hackers and incident response specialists, or navigating the murky waters of compliance and ESG challenges, SRM's insight and straightforward advice will help you navigate complex risks and emerge more resilient. Their secret? A culture that nurtures the sharpest minds, giving them access to the newest technologies and the freedom to solve problems in new ways, enabling them to craft simple, effective solutions for your unique cyber challenges. Search Your First Call to discover how SRM can help your business. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI. Our UK correspondent Carol Terrio has been tracking the growing sophistication of deepfakes and the concerns they've triggered. Today, she files this report on a new coalition that has set their sights on fighting deepfakes.
So according to Forbes, a coalition of technology companies set up to combat deepfakes has released the first version of its technical specification for digital provenance. The Coalition for Content Provenance and Authority, C2PA, Not exactly a name that slips off the tongue. However, according to Forbes, C2PA counts Adobe, Microsoft, ARM, Intel, TruePic, and the BBC amongst the illustrious list of members. And the gist is this. Platforms can define what information is associated with each type of asset. By asset, I mean an image, a video, a podcast, a document. And they can specify how that information is presented and stored and how evidence of tampering can be identified. In other words, it allows content creators to selectively disclose information about who has created or changed digital content and how it's been altered. Leonard Rosenthal, chair of C2PA's technical working group and senior principal scientist at Adobe, is quoted in Forbes saying, "As the C2PA pursues the implementation of open digital provenance standards, prototyping and communication from coalition members and other external stakeholders will be critical to establish a system of verifiable integrity on the internet." Okay, that is a statement written by committee if ever I saw one, because it is nebulous at best. But let me just distill what I think it is trying to say. Hey guys, get on board with this, otherwise it's going to fail. But you know, these things get complicated. They always do. Maybe not all deep fakes are bad. Consider the movies, for example. According to technical.lee, the big movie houses started using the technology that is deep fakes to reduce the cost of movie production during the Rona pandemic. That too is a slippery slope. How long before some actor breaks his leg and is contractually obliged to have a deep fake play his role? Or what if an actor is bidding for a role against a deepfake of Laurence Olivier? I mean, as the technology becomes ever more accessible, organizations will not only be the ones creating deepfakes. Individuals creating content on YouTube and other video platforms may well want to use deepfakes, if only just to make their channel pop. Oh, look, hey, look at the big celebrity that just popped in on my channel. I mean, I can see it. I'm predicting it now. So as always, we want to stop deepfakes for bad intentions. We want to regulate the use of deepfakes in good intentions. And we want to look at how it can be used by the common person in order to advance the technology in a safe way. Not a big ask, right? This was Carol Terrio for The Cyberwire.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And I'm pleased to be joined once again by Andrea Little-Limbago. She is the Vice President of Research and Analysis at Interos. Andrea, it is always a pleasure to welcome you back to the show. There is a term that I saw coming out of, I believe, the UK, and it's data traps. You being a data scientist, I thought you'd be the perfect person to check in on what exactly this means and what the implications are. What can you share with us today?
Yeah, no, thanks for bringing this up. It really hasn't risen to a lot of attention. But back in December of 2021, the UK intel chief brought this notion and warned against both debt traps and data traps. Now, debt traps have been used before, and that basically is the weaponization of debt where countries provide other countries loans to get leverage over them. And so we see that a lot. And so that, you know, that wasn't really what was as novel, something to be concerned about for sure, but wasn't as novel, as of also sort of tying that into data traps. What they noted was that, you know, if you allow another country to gain access to your data and gain control of that data, basically it erodes your sovereignty. And so what he was really was warning about was the access that other governments are starting to have to both public and private sector data as an erosion of sovereignty and control, and as a means for leverage as well. And so what they're really looking at is, you know, is looking at data as basically this resource, right, a strategic resource. And he's framing it in that lens. And I think for many governments, especially, you know, digital authoritarians that we've talked about for sure, you know, really do look at data as a strategic resource. And democracies really haven't done that as much. That's shifting, but really haven't done that as much. And so that's where you see why it was so important for the UK intelligence chief to bring this up, was to highlight that this is, should be a concern of both the private and public sector, that knowing where your data is, making sure both that you're protecting it, you know, at home, but knowing where it is abroad and knowing what kind of access other, you know, adversaries may have to that data. And then what would happen to government, to your society, to your company, if that data was accessed. And I think, as we all know, you know, within this audience, you know, integrating various forms of data together can really lead to useful insights. So that's great. It also can lead to useful insights in negative ways against, you know, an entity as well. So it really is trying to, you know, raise the alarm about the necessity to protect your data, not just at home, but, you know, abroad.
It's interesting to me, you mentioned sort of the contrast between democracies and other governments. Is that a cultural thing? Do different nations approach their attitude towards data in different ways?
Yeah, I think they definitely do. And on the one hand, you know, it's kind of a spectrum. And we absolutely can point to areas where democracies and democratic governments have overreached in areas of civil liberties and human rights. So it's not saying that democracies are completely devoid of any kind of activity in that realm. But the extent of which it goes on and sort of the guardrails that are in place to prevent it are very, very different. And so you do see amongst the digital authoritarians really the quest to, I think of it as data hoarding, bring in as much data as possible. And that's why you see everything from, you know, the OPM attack, which feels like about a decade ago at this point, you know, through, you know, the healthcare data that's getting attacked, through airline data getting, you know, taken in, through, you know, like hotel membership data, like all that different data basically can be pattern of life when brought together. And can be used for just a variety of means. And that's not even mentioning some of the IP theft as well that we've seen. And so you see more of the authoritarians looking at no target as being off limits. For the democracies, really, you know, it focuses much more so on, you know, what we do, like, you know, in quotes, you know, traditional espionage, not necessarily targeting IP or the commercial entities. It's more so for, you know, the leadership and espionage along those lines versus the theft of IP. And so it does create a very different playing field between the two. And that's really what I think the UK chief was really trying to highlight, was whether it's your company or within your digital supply chain and your partners that may have your data elsewhere, to be really concerned about that. And even in the policies that we see, you see, like, the General Data Protection Regulation, the EU, is protecting data for individual citizens, whereas elsewhere, from Russia to China, Kazakhstan, you really across a lot of these, you know, actually Thailand, Vietnam, many, many countries increasingly have data localization requirements, so you have to store the data there. Additional policies and regulations then add components as far as, oh, and we can access this data if we deem it, you know, essential to national security. And that umbrella of what is essential to national security basically is endless for them. So there's a big risk of storing that data abroad with the government that could have easy access to it.
Well, and we're seeing, I think it's the EU that's been going head to head with Facebook over data storage and being able to transfer data overseas, across the ocean, and trying to keep some sovereignty to their data. I mean, is that part of what we're talking about here?
I think it is, and I think that's an additional component of it, because on the one hand, we do see sort of the splintering of the internet and the different sovereign areas. And so the challenge is how can we have the free flow of data, because that is really essential for your functioning economies, while still preserving sovereignty and individual data rights. And I think in the Facebook case, it's especially relevant for the case of looking at the citizens' data and maintaining control over the citizens' data. Whereas for some of the other instances, it might be that they may want more so the free flow of data along the lines of commercial information and so forth for, you know, economic purposes. And so, you know, not all data is the same. And I think we're starting to get into an area as well where we'll start seeing some, you know, distinct categorizations of different kinds of data, which will then have different policies applied to them. So, I mean, if we think we have a patchwork of of policies and regulations now. I think that's just going to continue to explode. Hopefully, you know, it's done well in the direction of greater security. But we will see, because at the same time, there are concerns over, you know, everyone trying to create their digital fortress around a country, because that also, you know, leads to the, you know, basically digital protectionism, and that isn't optimal for the free flow of information and ideas either. So there's going to have to be a balance.
Yeah. All right. Well, Andrea Little-Limbago, thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Trey Hester, Brandon Karpf, Eliana White, Peru Prakash, Justin Sabi, Tim Dodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late. SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the dark net, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire.